This is an interview with Keith Vukasinovich for the Youngstown State University Project on the Black Student Experience. This interview is being conducted using WebEx. So today's date is August 18, 2023, and my name is Talicia Williams. Hello, Mr. Vukasinovich.
Hello.
How are you?
Really good.
That's good. Can we start off with where did you grow up? Where are you from?
I am from Youngstown, Ohio. I grew up on the south side of Youngstown and lived there until I was 26 years old. Went to, oh goodness, Hillman Monroe Elementary School, then Hillman Elementary School, then Princeton Junior High School, then Cardinal Mooney, and I did 2 degrees at Youngstown State.
What was your experience like growing up on the south side of Youngstown?
Not bad, honestly. It looks a lot different from the way it did. I'm 52, so what, 30 something years ago. Originally I lived on Granite, right, just a couple blocks from Volney Rogers Park, and then lived a few blocks away from South High School. And had a really good time growing up on the south side. There were still steel mills in Youngstown when I was little, for a while, and then the collapse happened towards the latter part of my childhood. So I don't have bad childhood memories. I loved Mill Creek Park as a kid growing up. It was big fun, you know. So yeah, it's definitely something I've noticed. Few cities have a metro park system. It's anything like Mill Creek Park. So I will say, I can't say I grew up in the golden age of Youngstown, but maybe the afterglow of its best days not being so far behind it that you couldn't see. Again, it's very different. I come home still about once a quarter. My mom still lives in the Struthers. So I come up to see her, check on her. Until recently, I had a business in Youngstown, but I sold it last spring. Well, in Liberty, just over the border from Northside into Trumbull County. So I know back home we consider that a whole different city, but compared to most places, that's still greater Youngstown. It's not like how Youngstown and Warren act like there's a giant ocean separating the two of them. Good experience though.
What do you remember about your childhood, like the differences that you saw in Youngstown after the steel mills closed?
You know, I think steel mills, you know, closing changed a lot, but I think it wasn't quite the gut punch of watching some of the Packards go away. Because then it was, you know, it was like there could be tumbleweed coming through Youngstown at that point. I think when the steel mills left, that was kind of a, you know, they knew it was coming, but they didn't really think about, surely it's not going to happen. You know, same thing with GM and automotive industry here in Ohio. But it changed the dynamic of things. I mean, you got to remember Youngstown was a steel mill town, and it was the kind of place where most people graduated from high school, if they bothered to graduate from high school, and went straight to work in them steel mills and lived good. Maybe even made good money, worked hard, but lived good working middle-class lives. The loss of the Rust Belt experience of the Midwest definitely did not spare Youngstown. I mean, I've recently actually seen some black and white movies from World War II where they were talking about the making of steel in Youngstown. I'm like, damn, we really were. We were all that. Okay, so yeah, but I think Youngstown's got a scrappy spirit to it. A friend of mine's a stockbroker who used to visit when his stepfather would kind of drag him to Youngstown to visit his family there. He would always say, if you could make it in Youngstown, you could make it anywhere. And I think that mindset has really gotten me far in life. I love it when I see the Ohio map meme when it has Mahoney County. It has Where the Godfather Meets the Wire. And I chuckle because that has become such an accurate description of Youngstown. But I remember when I really don't think it still has the whole organized crime, misnomer. Not that that wasn't appropriate. That was appropriate before I was even really born. By the time you were in the 60s, 70s, all that stuff was in decline. Hell, corporate America is more of a gangster than organized crime could ever be. So now that said, you know, the experience of being Black, or as my last name probably gives significant hints, growing up in a family that was on both sides of the color line, there have always been two different versions of Youngstown, just like any other city in America. The experience of African Americans rarely is a apples to apples comparison of the experience of mainstream America. So Youngstown was no different in that aspect.
You talk about having experience on both sides of the color line. What do you mean by that?
My mother's family were literally immigrants from Serbia that came to Youngstown for the steel mill industry. I'm part of the first generation in that family born in America. My dad's family was from the Chicago area, lived in Youngstown, got in trouble, went to Chicago, changed his name, and moved back to Youngstown kind of story. So, my dad's an interesting soul. His family, my dad's family, he is one of 11, 9 boys and 2 girls. And of them 11, 9 have been to the penitentiary. So I have this hippie social justice wildflower mom, and dad was a whole different flavor, shall we say. Okay. So you grew up watching both sides of that, because needless to say, her family couldn't stand my dad. My dad's family gave zero about what anybody thought of them. I remember one of my friends who grew up on the north side, when his dad realized who my dad was, he said, "The problem with your daddy back in the day was you couldn't fight just one of them. And there was so damn many of them." So, it really did. It's always been a part of my my perspective on things. When I did my master's at Youngstown State, my thesis was actually on biracial identity development. And I am actually, at 52, a PhD student down at University of Cincinnati in the counseling program. And I focus on issues relevant to Black men across the life course. So the dynamic of how race factors into one's sense of self and one's social identity is something that probably was such a relevant component of my childhood that that's explains a lot about my career path later on in life.
What year did you start at ISU?
I started in June of 89, literally like 2 weeks after I graduated from Mooney. And I graduated 93 after a slight change of plans, and then did a master's. And I finished my master's, I want to say summer of 96. But when I originally came to Youngstown State, I came in what was then the combined BSMD program between, it was called Neo-UCOM at the time, and the three campuses were Kent, Youngstown State, and Akron. Now I think it's called Neomed, and I don't know how any of that. I don't think there is a BSMD program anymore. I just think it's the med school for the universities in Northeastern Ohio. But I was almost finished with my first half of that program and decided I did not want to be a doctor, and walked away from a full ride scholarship, and my mama lost her damn mind. What are you doing? You know, all the things. Hey, shit, with my kids, I'd do the same damn thing. If one of my kids told me they were walking away from a full ride to medical school, I'd probably choke them out. I'm not going to say I'd handle that well. But in the grand scheme of things, it worked out. I got my master's, and with the opioid epidemic in Ohio, ended up creating not one or two, but three behavioral health networks that I sold each one. And at one point I had more Suboxone waivered physicians working for me than any other provider for CareSource in the entire state. So yeah, so it worked out. It didn't, you know, even though I won't lie, there were points when I asked myself, what the hell have I done? But it worked out. It worked out. But yeah, that was my time at YSU. I had a great time at YSU. Being there for an undergraduate and graduate school was like being an undergraduate for 6 years. And I pledged a fraternity my sophomore year. And there is nothing quite like the life of being an undergraduate Q. So Youngstown State may not have been an HBCU, but you couldn't tell my ass it wasn't. I had a damn fine time. So hanging out in Kilcawley Center. And I think the big joke that we all laugh about, and I know you guys interviewed Kenny King. He may have told you it was funny when the president of the Black Student Union was Keith Vukasinovich, and he changed the name of the organization to the Pan-African Student Union. And, you know, so you got this like demilitant flavor to things, and on paper, everybody's like, but there's a white boy in charge of everything. So that was an interesting period in time at Youngstown State. But it was good. Honestly, we had a lot of fun back then. There were still, and I don't know what the nature of things is now, because I haven't been on campus in forever. But we had the Black students really did. They were like their coherent little own community, which was funny because when I first came to campus, you know, mind you, I'm in the BSMD program. I'm with all these damn Indian kids, and my hair was much longer then, like down to my shoulders, okay? And I had gone to Mooney before Mooney had uniforms. So I get to college, and I'm dressing like your typical college white kid. I'm dressed bummy as shit, and because I've had a dress code, but not more than that, because I really do tease. My class was the reason why Mooney had uniforms afterwards, because we wore things. We wore patience then. So I get to YSU. I'm walking around campus. And when you're in the BSMD program, you guys are kind of always all in the same classes. So you're moving from building to building, big groups of Indian kids. So finally, I went up to one sister in Kilcawley. I'll never forget her name this day. Her name was Twyla. And I was like, what's going on campus? I was like, brothers ain't real friendly on here. She looked at me like, well, why would you say that? And I went, ain't nobody spoke to me since I got here. And she said, well, that's because y'all don't usually interact with us. And I went, y'all? Who's y'all? And she was like, Indian students. And I was like, oh, I ain't no Indian. I am definitely Black. Okay, I mean, I was like indignant. I felt like my Black card had been questioned. And I was like, oh, hell no. And literally, I went home because, again, back then, a lot of us Black folks, when we came to campus, we was dressed. You'd have thought folks was going to job interviews every day on campus. I mean, we kept it tight. I went home, you know, to my mom, and I was like, Mom, they didn't know I was Black, okay? And she went, you dress like a, my mom had gone to watch you. She goes, you dress like a bum. You need a haircut. I ain't surprised. You leave here looking like an embarrassment every day. So I probably got my first fade ever. Okay. And that was the beginning of my, I was welcomed home like a wayward son in the Black students at YSU. But I will never forget that they were like, well, you walk in these big groups with all of them, none of them talk to us. You kind of look like, I was like, oh no, I gotta fix this. So probably factored into me pledging Q the next school year too, because I was like, I boiled down, I was like, what's the blackest of the Black frats? And I was like, Q, that's me, that's what I wanna be. Yeah, and that was, Jesus, I've been a Q for 32 years now. So But yeah, all that kind of started at Youngstown State with, my black card getting questioned when I got to campus. That hurt my soul. That's why I ain't forgot that shit. But if that was 89, here we are, 23, 33, 30 something years later, it's still, I can remember that shit like that conversation was yesterday. Oh my God. But yeah, Youngstown State. I don't think the campus looks that different. You guys got a few more buildings around the perimeter and everything, but the core of it's still, at least from the segments of it I've seen, I haven't walked across campus in years, but
Yeah,
it don't
that
look
was going through a
different.
lot of different construction, like even downtown. Everything is getting reconstructed. You can't even drive on the streets anymore. So it's probably gonna, I graduate this year, so I don't know, but it's probably gonna look different in a few years.
Like I said, around the perimeter, it's changed. Like UC, where I'm at right now, with me being at UC, I went to UC for another master's in 2006, and that campus now, compared to what it was 15 years ago, I don't even recognize it, other than the building where my classes are at, because I'm in the same college, which got a complete redo that building, because it was a dump 15 years ago, and now it looks stately. But that whole campus is different in 15 years. Youngstown State, I feel like I could still find my way around if I needed to. The core around the quad hasn't changed significantly to my knowledge. Is the rock still there outside Kilcawley? Did they paint every year? But I have good memories of Youngstown State. Nothing bad. And Trestle, I was there all 6 years Trestle won championships. So that made the football experience of being at Youngstown State something that was unique compared to any of its history before or after. So those were good times.
Earlier, you mentioned the change in your major, like what you were going to do when you went to school. You were a med student, and then you changed majors. What happened? Why did you change?
When my senior year at Mooney, I guess growing up on the South Side, even back then, wasn't all flowers and sunshine. I got into a shootout my senior year and literally made the newspaper as the honor student from Mooney who was being arraigned on manslaughter charges. And let's be clear, it wasn't a shootout I started. But once you start shooting at me, I'm inclined to shoot back. I'm just wired that way. And in honesty, in hindsight, I was struggling with undiagnosed PTSD and barely keeping it together. I mean, my grades weren't bad. I was surviving. I was keeping my scholarship. But I'm definitely in hindsight, I was drinking way more than I should have been drinking. And my stress level and depression, there was a lot of mood swings going on. And I was like, I'm gonna leave this BSMD program because I've been able to fake the funk for 2 solid years, but I don't know if I can fake it once I get to the medical school side of this. And so I was like, I made the decision. I said, I'm gonna leave before they figure out how bad I'm struggling and ask me to leave. So let me leave while I've got some financial aid intact and I can kind of figure out where I'm going from here. But because of the accelerated nature of everything, I had had so many calculus, biology, chemistry classes that, but I just knew, I said, I'm gonna hit a wall, because the anatomy classes, it was getting difficult to stay focused enough to do everything while I'm trying to hide the fact that inside I'm a hot mess. And every time a car backfires or something, my hands start shaking. So I was struggling with a lot. And I think the master's program, because as soon as I did my undergraduate, I finished up, I completed almost all the requirements for majors in psychology, sociology, and black studies. I was one class short in black studies because I refused to take another class with Sarah Brown Clark after the experience of my first class with her. And I know Sarah's popular there, and this is water under the bridge. And I've seen Sarah many times after this, but in class, she told me, in front of other students, And I might have been like a junior then, that in her book, I didn't have a real black experience because one of my parents was white. And I thought that was the dumbest shit I'd ever heard in my life when you have people like Frederick Douglass who had a white parent. Okay, that you know, the ridiculous of the attempt to negate one's experience because you did not approve of their pedigree is the sort of shit we've been struggling with as black folks forever. And oftentimes the worst of that stupid stuff we do to each other. So I finished the majors in psychology, sociology, and one class short of finishing everything for Black Studies, but I wasn't taking 701 after the experience with her in 601. And then I did the master's in counseling there because it was paid for. You know, and literally, I was always good at making sure I found scholarships. So I was at Youngstown State. I was working. By my senior year, I was already a third shift supervisor at UPS. I was making good money. There was no incentive to go nowhere else. So I stayed and did another master's, and with working third shift, that was great because it didn't matter when my classes were. Work was never going to conflict with classes. The other nice part about it was that when you work third shift and y'all decide to go out on Friday or Saturday night, nobody can stay up later than you can because you're used to being up all night long. So it probably did not help some of the partying I needed to get under control. But yeah, so that's how I ended up from the BSMD to finishing my Bachelor's Arts in Psychology, and then the MS-Ed program in counseling.
You said your experience with Sarah Brown Clark. She told you you didn't have a real black experience because you were biracial.
Yeah,
Did you run
basically.
into experiences like that a lot while you were in college or high school?
I'm sorry, it was a little garbled. I couldn't quite hear what you said.
Did you run into experience like that a lot where like your blackness was questioned because you had a parent?
Yeah, to be honest, in Youngstown, no. Youngstown got a lot of mixed kids, as we was called back in the day, okay? I mean, so much so to the point of when I left Youngstown, and now mind you, I have a summer tan right now, okay? But I was of the opinion that folks my complexion were brown skin, okay? I did not realize I had never been called yellow until I left Youngstown. Okay, somebody said something. I was somewhere and they went over there with them light skin ninjas, and I went, "Excuse me, I'm brown." And they were like, "No, nigga, you are not." Okay, and I was like, "Oh, I." So that's the closest I think I've ever had to anybody saying anything like that. But in my neighborhood, where I grew up on the South Side, there were like four or five other biracial kids, you know, and you know, I think, you know, the artifacts, the interesting things about growing up in Youngstown wasn't, you know, being biracial. There were so many interracial couples and biracial kids and everything. It wasn't unusual. And even from when when I go home and I jokingly say when I go out to Club Walmart, because you see all the best of Youngstown at Walmart in Boardman, okay? Clearly, biracial kids is still a thing in Youngstown because you will see a whole bunch of folks out with their grandkids who are definitely not the same flavor as they are, okay? But it wasn't anything that was questioned. You know, even my dad's family would say things like, "Yeah, your mom's white, but you're still one of us. So what difference does it make?" So growing up with that kind of acceptance, if anything, I think it seemed like when I left Youngstown and kind of lived and traveled in other places, being biracial was more unique, at least, you know, 30 years ago. Now, I really don't think so much, but it was different then. Now, you know, it's funny because I know I did my master's in biracial identity development, but there's another student in UC who's doing her PhD on basically biracial identity stuff. And I couldn't help but think, what a boring topic at this point, because the differentiation of trying to We give every category, we want every category of excuse to call yourself anything other than Black. And I think that's a whole different psychological issue going on right there, because we don't do that with other ethnic groups. But I think that one of the reasons why we've kind of shrank demographically from being 14% of the population to 12 nationally is because we've literally given people the option to opt out of being called Black. And when you continue to send as a society a negative message about being Black, it's not surprising that when folks have private opportunities to identify something else, they do. You know, I remember the first picture Bible my mom gave me was a Black picture Bible. And my mom was probably the coolest white lady, I think, on the planet. She said to me early on that here in this house, you're mixed. Here in this house, you are as much white as you are Black. You walk outside them doors, you're Black. So you may as well have a mindset that you're Black. And that's just that. And I'm like four getting this lecture. I'm thinking, oh, okay. But, you know, I think more folks could have benefited from that lecture. You know, maybe, you know, if Tiger had gotten that lecture instead of Kablazian, he wouldn't have got his ass whooped with his own golf clubs. You know, I just think that there is a, we need to have more of a healthy acceptance of folks identifying themselves as being Black. With only Africans who are not in Africa who are embarrassed about calling themselves African. And that seems like something that needs to be addressed. From my position, you know, as a therapist practicing for 23 years. So.
And how would you say that people should address that when they have difficulties with their identity, especially being biracial? How would you say that our society should address that issue?
I think that it gets perhaps too much of the limelight. I'm cautious whenever somebody, because with a last name like mine, invariably someone will ask, you know, now when other Black folks ask, I don't ever mind clarifying, because you know, if I say something in room for Black, hi, my name is Keith Vukasinovich, invariably there'll be a sister who'll go, like, you know, and I'm like, let me explain, you know, okay. But I also have mainstream folks ask, like, so about that last, like I have to explain this shit to them, like somehow an explanation is due. And I've gotten to the point where I'm roguish with it, because the last white Vukasinovich left in America is my mama. That's it. All the rest of them are brown, and most of them live in my house. So if somebody asks me, well, what kind of name is that? I'll say Black. Most of the folks I know with it are Black. So, but if somebody asks from a genuine point of being curious, I'll say it's a Serbian last name, because in Serbian cultural traditions, when your parents are not married, unlike here in America, you are only considered a part of your mother's family. So, like here we have situations where you could have one mama who's had kids with a few different dads, and you would theoretically have a house full of folks with the different last names, which could be a little bit chaotic, you know. In Serbia, it didn't matter how many baby daddies she had. If her last name was Popovich, all them damn kids was Popoviches. So there's no, and in hindsight, you know, looking through the lens of kind of life experience, I actually think that's a better damn idea. But most of us don't realize that the legacy of changing up how one was defined in terms of last names, a lot of that in America has more of its roots in slavery than it does in any positive social structures. So being the Black Vukasinovich, I will say this much: when people meet me, they tend not to forget me, because, you know, or if they meet somebody who's related to me, it's not uncommon for my kids to be out somewhere and they'll go, you related to Keith? And yeah, that's my fault. You know, okay. It's cool. It means people are the wolves. So I jokingly say some of us were destined to end up being Qs whenever my bros would give me the hell about my last name. So.
Why did you ultimately make the decision to become a Q here at YSU?
The surgeon, the shootout my senior year is a little bit more complicated than I'm saying on tape, but my mom was shot. And the surgeon who saved her life was Dr. Ernest Perry. And he is a great Omega man with a long history of doing good by the community in Youngstown. So, yeah, my expression of a desire to be a Q had a lot to do with knowing that Dr. Perry saved my mom's life. So that, and I won't lie, it'd be nice to make it sound all noble and everything, but the other part of the matter is I was at a party in Kent State, and them brothers came in stepping like they owned the damn place, and I went, I have got to be one of these because they took over the party. And yeah, it was great. I mean, if anybody wants to be a part of the Divine Nine, I strongly suggest do that as an undergrad, because the experience that you'll have as an undergraduate, you will never get a chance to have that particular experience again. So it is just wonderful to get that, because it's not going, it's a unique part of Greek life for us. And I just think we should make the most of those opportunities. And Youngstown State, when I was there, we had alphas. Those were the football players by and large, because at the time, alpha had the lowest GPA requirement. Don't tell none of them I said that, but they all know that's true. Okay. They had all you had to have was a 2.0 to be an alpha. So as long as you were in good standing, you could pledge, which meant most of the football team could pledge. Okay. You had the kappas, which everybody expected me to pledge. You had the Q's and you had the sigmas on the yard. Iotas were not a formal thing then. They were more like Bigfoot. You heard of them, but you hadn't really seen them. And the brother who was the Q was the vice president of student government. And again, I admired that he partied hard, but he handled his business and he actually owned a business off campus. So, I think the mix of those things, seeing how Paul played hard, but he partied hard and handled his business, Dr. Perry, and then seeing the bruh step at Kent State, all that, yeah. Definitely. Ironically, everybody I was online with dropped the first night, so I had to go through the whole process by myself. But I jokingly say it was probably only them pissing me off by dropping and gave me the enthusiasm to get through the rest of that quarter, because it was not fun being the only lamp in sessions for 14 weeks. That was not fun, but it was survivable. It was. 90s were also a crazy time for hazing in all the organizations, because that same around the same time I was online, the Kappas had a huge hazing incident to get them kicked off the yard. And it's been interesting because I know since I left campus, there was an incident where there was a shootout at the Q house where the one Omega lost his life. But we some of us older bros were talking, have talked about that many a time. But yeah, Greek life's changed. I don't know what it's like on the campus now. Youngstown's always had a very small number of Qs. Sometimes the undergraduate chapter's active, sometimes it's not. And when it's active, it's Theta Gamma. When it's not, they go through Psi Omicron. The Q's were notorious for only crossing one dude at a time during the 90s. The 90 dude, Kevin McMullen, was the only person to come off of that line. I was the only one off of the 92, or excuse me, 91 line. And Craig Stubbs was the only one to cross on the 92 line afterwards. And then there wasn't another line for the rest of the time that I was there from 93 to 96. There were no more. For that period, I was honestly, me and Craig were probably the only two Qs on campus. So.
I was gonna mention that the Q's were like never like that fraternity was never as big as the other ones. It's like you don't find much of it in like the old student dorm bars or any yearbooks. It was a very small fraternity. You also mentioned that after the first night you pledged, almost everybody else dropped out. Why was that?
Like I said, there had been a big hazing incident with the Kappas a couple of weeks before our line started, and it shut everything down. And the other three dudes I was starting the Lampado process with were like, look, we can get away with not pledging and just go in paper. And I said, are y'all crazy? We are within driving distance of like a dozen universities. Dudes will roll here just to whoop our ass if we try and cross without pledging as undergrads. That might get you out of the hazing right now, but it's going to mean getting hazed for the rest of your life. It's a really bad idea. And the other three dudes dropped out. Didn't even show up for the first night. So the very first ass whooping I took was knocking on that door, not being able to explain where my line brothers were at. And I didn't talk to them dudes for probably 7, 8 years. I mean, I could walk past one of them in Kilcawley, and it would be like I walked past a ghost. I wouldn't say anything because I was heated about the fact that the very first ass whooping I took was because they didn't show up. So that's how that first night went. But I would, you know, I can jokingly say, of course there have always been less cues. Making all the best shit takes more effort. Okay. But the issue was the fact that in the 90s, our hazing was crazy. There were only like four active undergraduate chapters in the entire 4th district, and that's Ohio and West Virginia. At the time I crossed, Kent was active, Ohio State was active, Toledo, and I think the University of West Virginia. But Cincinnati had just lost its chapter for a hazing incident, as had University of Pittsburgh. So... four freaking active undergraduate chapters in 2 states because of how off the chain things were. I think these days, actually, I watch from the sidelines, I see the Kappas getting themselves into more trouble as they're trying to go from the pretty boy image to the nasty noop. And I'm like, y'all need to learn from our history that nasty shit comes with a whole lot of downside litigation. So, just being pretty is what I want to tell them, but they're going to do their own thing. So,
do you feel like the hazing issue was the reason why no one else pledged? Why you guys were only like one line?
No doubt. No doubt. There were a lot of folks who did not want to go through hazing, and it was what it was. I mean, the fact that it's an entirely underground process for all of the Divine Nine, I'm on a membership, what it's called, membership selection process team now. And the thing that's changed is now all of us are personally, we basically give and I'm sure every organization does the same thing, is you basically indemnify your organization against hazing. And you know that if you do any hazing, that you are liable personally and your personal assets can be attacked. Bruz had you fill out the paperwork saying that you would not participate in hazing, tore it up in front of you, and commenced to work. but again, I can look at it and laugh now, but oh man, you know, for a young brother that was already struggling with depression, it probably wasn't the smartest damn thing I'd ever done. But I used to tease the Ghetto Boys song, My Mind's Playing Tricks on Me, was out then, and that was like my pledge song. I would drive around just listening to that. But man, once it got on the other side, you know, especially having crossed solo, and being the Q whose last name is Vukasinovich, and then was undergraduate scholar like 2 years in a row, it was a whole different life. But yeah, I mean, it was a fun undergraduate experience. I know my sons, who are all college age, are like, oh hell no, I ain't doing none of that shit, daddy. I was like, I get it, I didn't talk too much, y'all don't want no parts of that. They used to crack up when we had when they were little and our dog was little, I would literally put a dog biscuit in my mouth and hand it to the dog, because after pledging, the flavor of dog biscuits didn't bother my ass anymore. It was like,
did they make you eat dog biscuits when you were
Since the camera's gone, I will simply say that the flavor of dog biscuits didn't bother me by the time I graduated from college. Okay? So, yeah. So the kids were like, Daddy, how can you give the dog a biscuit? Like, it don't bother me. So,
Wow, that's insane.
oh yeah.
Where did you live when you were on campus?
I right after high school, I was in an apartment in Brownlee Woods. I had my dad was a vet, so I had VA benefits and scholarships and all kinds of stuff. So I had enough money to live off campus. And again, I was a third shift supervisor at UPS. So I'm a student at Youngstown State, driving around in a brand new, at the time, Mazda MX-6. I was having a great time. College was fun. To think back then, I was probably making the equivalent of like $25 an hour. And that
Wow.
was in the early 90s, that was just like epic.
Yeah, that
So,
was
yeah, absolutely. It was enough that when I left, I think it was probably harder leaving that job to take a student. I took a graduate assistantship in the last 2 years of my master's to get experience. So when I went from that to tuition plus, it was a $7,000 a year stipend back then. I was thankful I had saved up some money because my pockets got drafty. With 7 grand is your whole pay for the entire school year. So, but yeah, that was Youngstown. It was a good experience. I don't have any negativity about Youngstown. I still think in hindsight of the if I had to, knowing everything I know now, if I had to rewind and choose again, at the time with BSMD, you got to choose Akron, Kent, or Youngstown State. I'd have still chosen Youngstown State, given the dynamics at that point in time. It was a good experience, and I get no complaints.
Being a part of the Q fraternity, you mentioned a lot of crazy stuff that you guys did while you were a Q. But what was some of the stuff that you guys did as far as like community outreach? Did you guys participate in that kind of stuff? Did you guys volunteer? Do
Yeah, the
fraternal
graduate
campus
chapter,
resources?
because so much Youngstown State's chapter is so closely affiliated with the graduate, we did a lot of things. A lot of times we would do stuff in the middle schools, in the elementary schools, like reading with kids, helping with homework, doing little step shows at the schools for the kids. They loved it, teaching the little kids how to step. A lot of times, like if we would throw a party on campus, we would give half the money to the graduate chapter to fund different programs. So there was always an investment in doing more. So.
You were the president of the BSU while you were an undergraduate, right? How did you become president of BSU?
I just got involved, honestly. The program was struggling, and part of the reason for the change from BSU to Pan-African Student Union is there was like this schism between the international students who were from Africa and the black students, because their attitude was that they didn't feel like the black student union reflected their interests. They were like, this is y'all stuff, not us. And I was like, well, we got to fix that. So we got together, talked about changing it, and yeah, we took it. We wanted to eliminate the excuse for all of us to be anything but supportive of each other. So that's how it went from BSU to Pan-African Student Union, was to make sure that we were trying to extend, fellowship and friendship to black folks from everywhere. And it worked. We ended up having students who were participating who were from Nigeria, Jamaica, all over. So it served the purpose to change the name to make sure the mission was clear. So,
What kind of things did you do as president of the BSU?
oh, we made sure that we every opportunity we had to get the university to pay for a field trip for us to go to some black history functions at Kent State, at Pitt, Akron, Cleveland State. We did outreach. There was one time even an ex-Klan came to Youngstown to do a concert at, oh goodness, I want to say the campus. I want to say the camp. The concert was, it seems like it was somewhere outdoors, but I don't remember where it was. But actually, even a lot of the brothers who were in the Pan African Student Union got to help out and like work security and hang out with X Clan, which is funny because for how much she's changed in life, the last time I saw Omarosa Manigault in person, she was head to toe from crown down in a kente cloth outfit with her nose pierced. And to have gone from that to the Trump White House is like, whoa, baby girl, what happened? But yeah, that was, we really did try to stay involved and do things, not just in terms of community outreach, but trying to keep students healthy. We would do runs around Wick Park, and just trying to keep every, we, there was used to be a bookstore on Belmont that we would always hang out at and we would, you know, buy stuff from. I tried to make sure that the relationship between the Black Greek organizations and Pan-African Student Union stayed really, really positive. Because to me, initially, it was almost like there was a competitive flavor. You could either be, you know, you was either down with BSU or you were in one of the Greek letter organizations. And then you get the argument, well, there were no Black Greek. You know, look, we don't have to do all this, okay? We can all work together towards the fact that if somebody come running here right now and say, all you N-words get on the ground, they're not gonna say, oh, you Greeks are excluded or no. So let us just try and remember that we're all in this together. So I think that was the primary thing I was trying to do with BSU is to get as many of us to rally together as possible. And I do remember one time there was even a time when we were, some of the Pan-African student unions were bringing a van back late at night from a trip, I think, to Kent State, and campus police basically pulled them over with guns drawn. And I wrote a scathing editorial in the Jam Bar about that because I was like, oh, hell no. Like, what do you think? A group of Black students decided to steal a van and magically got to feeling their conscience and decided to return it at 2 a.m. to the depot where, was there a van reported stolen before you rolled up? I mean, I'm just curious. There's a lot of things you could have done before you came up to the van with guns out. I learned early on about the pen being mightier than the sword. And I'd give folks the blues and the Jam Bar if it was necessary. Again, I tried to make sure that we just did what we could to encourage each other on campus because so many of us came up there. And again, as I said, it was on the quarter system back then. And you would see some of us come there and play cards in the TV room and not go to class. And then the next quarter, they were on academic probation. And then by spring quarter, they were taking 2 semesters off to kind of think about life before they could come back. And I know 2 brothers who it probably took 17 years to graduate from Youngstown State. And I jokingly, it should have been a hint and a half that when I met them, when I came on as a freshman, they'd already been there 5 years. It should have been a hint to me that these was not the brothers to hang out with because graduating wasn't part of their agenda. But even they, thankfully, eventually got their degrees. But it's easy to get sucked into having a good time at college and not handle business. You know, and I think that's the one thing in hindsight that is very different in a PWI from an HBCU is I don't even remember any significant interactions with my advisors while I was an undergrad. I kind of came with a plan, had my own ideal, did my thing, boom. But I know I've seen because my oldest went to Morgan State in Baltimore and his advisor and he were always in communication. So just different.
Yeah. Now that's mandatory. You have to meet with an advisor, especially during your freshman year.
I'm sure.
You have to meet with an advisor. What was your relationship like with the white Greeks?
Other than the ones I knew from school, honestly, or the ones I would interact with in student government, I didn't really have one. I kind of kept to my clique, and my clique was decidedly brown and black. That I just it wasn't my thing. Not that there's anything wrong with it. I knew a couple of black guys who were in white fraternities, but again, other than the folks I was friends with through participating in student government, I really didn't have a relationship with. There used to be a book a long time ago, Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria? Okay, and I think that there's a we tend to self-select in the groups we feel comfortable with. Lord knows if I walk into a room full of folks and I see some brown folks, I will go, hey, what's up? I would, it's a different flavor of interaction. I think it may surprise some folks to hear a biracial person say that. As I said earlier, I just think we give too much credence to the idea that being biracial means you're not black, and or you're somehow one off or something, and that is a fool's errand to even go down that path. So I can't really say I had much, and it's in graduate school. Naturally, it was more because when I was a graduate student at Youngstown State, was one of seven black male graduate students in all of Youngstown State. And I think we all knew each other. Okay. So, which was crazy. I think there were 1,200 graduate students on campus at the time. To think that there were seven black men, I think there were like 40 something sisters, but that's still the case. I mean, right now with me and the PhD at UC, it's the first time in 30 years they've had two black men in a cohort at the same time. So the absence of African American men in undergraduate programs is an issue, period. And then in graduate schools, it's an even bigger issue. So we've spent a lot of time focused on trying to get sisters to go to school, and we've done a great job, but we took our eye off the ball with getting brothers to go to school as well. And that factors into all kinds of other stuff because college-educated women tend to look for college-educated men as spouses. And now we have the dynamic that the vast majority of college-educated black women, there's simply numerically not enough black college-educated men for kind of each one to get one. So kind of equation. Yeah, no, there's that what is it, like 60 or more percent of the college graduates in the community are women and female, African American females, compared to black males. So it's a numbers game. It changes the dynamic for the entire life course for us as a community.
You said you graduated in 1993 with a BA in psychology. Did you choosing psychology as a major have anything to do with your personal struggles with mental illness at that time?
Probably. I liked psychology in general. And it was something that was easy for me to delve down to get invested in mind stuff was always something that was easy. I've always been a bit more of an introvert, which is probably a surprise given the Q stuff, but I'm comfortable by myself. So yeah, I think that the psychology now, in truth, especially like the master's program, oh my God, if you said every person doing a master's in social work or psychology who's here doing this to figure out their shit must get out the room right now, you wouldn't have enough students in the classroom to hold a session. So yeah, they're the vast. I would say at least half the folks who are in behavioral health disciplines are there either because of their shit or the stuff going on with family members close to them. So that's just the nature of this field.
Earlier, you mentioned a little bit about having PTSD in your senior year of high school and throughout college. How did you manage to still keep your grades and be a stand-up student while struggling with so many deep internal issues, such as mental illness?
I was always really smart, really good in school. So school was an easy area to excel at. My C effort would still get A's in most circumstances. So it was easy to keep that shine going while, I wasn't really functional in relationships. I'm sure I was not the best boyfriend anybody ever had while they were in college. And it was only, honestly, after I basically sat down and really tried to work on self. And I think about it, like the last year of my master's, I was like, I ain't dating nobody. I've got to get this shit figured out. I am a hot mess. What, about a year after graduate school, met then girlfriend, now wife, been married 26 years, four kids. So, I wouldn't say that in any way, shape, or form, I still consider myself depressed or suffering from PTSD. But I think having gone through that has definitely made me more effective as a therapist, because I think I have relate a little differently to my clients when they're expressing, some stuff. It's not just something I read in a textbook. I know what a night terror is like. I know what it's like to not want to get out of bed. I know what it's like to have contemplated suicide. That's a different set of variables. To understand that you can have some remarkably functional appearing people who have some really dark stuff going on inside. So, and that's the population I like to work with right now, is it's great to help people learn how to sort out their own stories and move forward with life. That gets me up every morning. I love doing that. So it's cool. I tease, the universe sometimes puts people th through certain things to get what's necessary to do bigger things. If I'd become a physician early on in life, I'm pretty sure I'd be the standard young physician asshole. Arrogant, self-absorbed, the world, I am God, what you think. Man, and I don't think the universe needed one more of those, so it went, let me get this one off that path and get something that's actually going to be more helpful to the collective. And I'm all right with that. Wasn't all right with it at the time, okay? Didn't like going through none of that shit. But, sometimes it serves a bigger purpose.
Was there any faculty members that you have positive relationships with on campus? Like you said, you guys didn't really have like what is it called?
Advisors, we had them, but it wasn't mandatory. Ironically, like I said, my mom went to Youngstown State, so her advisor, Dr. Kyriazis, was on campus, and his son was teaching on campus too. So I had some folks who were keeping an eye out for me once I was out of the BSMD program. I knew if I need anything. And the hiding at the highest tier that I had, an ace up my sleeve, is a lady I kind of call my godmother, was Eugenia Atkinson, and she was on the board of trustees. So if ever I felt like something wasn't going well, it was always nice to be able to pick up a phone and call a trustee. And between my bachelor and C in my graduate school, the College of Education lost my application, and I had never applied to graduate school, so I didn't know something was up. So I call like 2 weeks before fall quarter is supposed to start. I'm like, hey, what's going on? They're like, well, graduate school lost your application. You're gonna have to wait until spring to start. I was like, wait. Y'all telling me that I turned everything on time, but because the College of Education or the Graduate Studies Department lost my app and didn't send it to you until 2 weeks afterwards, now I'm screwed. And the lady said, basically, excuse me, one second. Hey. Have a seat, good brother. I'll be wrapping up the Zoom. Basically said to me, yeah, you're screwed. And so I picked up the phone, called Eugenia, told her what happened, and she said, baby, wait by the phone. About an hour later, the provost called me, explained that I would have an interview in the department the next day. I went to the counselor education department, and I sat down with the chair and another professor. And after basically a 15-minute bullshit conversation. They walked me down to Lincoln and registered me for classes. And it was funny because then we walked up to where the department was. And I saw the very same secretary who had said to me, well, those are your words, not mine, but basically. And I looked at it and I said, I guess I'm not so out of luck after all, huh?
Yeah.
So I had folks who were looking out for me, even though it wasn't a guarantee, you know, that most folks don't have that to fall back on, but I did, so it was cool. So.
Did you feel connected to a larger community, like outside of school? Like being a fraternity, you got, like you said, you guys did a lot of community outreach and going around campus and interacting with people. And even in the BSU, you said you guys did a lot of activities with keeping students healthy, keeping students active, and stuff like that. Did you ever build like a larger community outside of YSU?
Not really, honestly. We even though we would road trip as a crew to Kent State or Pitt, back then, you know, there was no social media. So your connect was you literally knew somebody on the campus. You know, it wasn't as easy to build community then as it is now. So we really were kind of a little island of our own. You know, and even Youngstown State, you know, Youngstown State's different from being on the lower north side. You know, being on a student versus living halfway up Elm ain't the same experience. So, yeah, we were really kind of a little bubble.
Your current career right now is a therapist?
Yeah, I'm a therapist. I do a lot of school-based programming. I do some work with the military. And then I have a small private practice, about 10 clients a week, I see.
Do you feel as though YSU helped to prepare you or provide the right tools for you to do what you do now?
Oh, yeah. Youngstown State's MS Ed program was one of the first ones in the state to offer the clinical license option without having a PhD. So it was called basically, you could do your master's, and then there was what was called the 30 plus program after you finish your master's. So it was, even then it was unique amongst master's counseling level programs. So yeah, it was a solid program. I've seen a lot of master's level programs that I think are not as good around the state of Ohio, but yeah, Youngstown State's a good program.
Where did you first start working when you finished school?
Valley Counseling Service in Warren, Ohio. I worked at their children's office for 2.5 years before I moved to Dayton, Ohio.
Why did you make the decision to move to Dayton?
Job opportunities. Honestly, there were more opportunities here. And the cost of living was similar, but just by moving, I like doubled my income just by moving to Dayton.
Well, is there anything else you want to add for like students like me, or maybe students 20, 30 years in the future who are going to come back and listen to this interview or read it in the archives or in the student history? What would you like to say to kids?
I would say,
maybe struggling with mental illness, or maybe having an identity crisis, or just struggling in general.
Look for mentors. Honestly, find somebody who looks like they might actually have their stuff together, and pester them. Okay. Most of the best mentor-mentee relationships are not because some mentor was out there going, that one. They happen because somebody is like, oh, I'm gonna bother you until you teach me shit, okay? That having that kind of, you know, look for rooms full of people who know more shit than you and fight your way in there. And then the minute you are the most informed person in that room, find another room. But keep that kind of grind about learning from people who you always wanna be. That I just barely made it in whatever organization. You want it to have such high standards that you ask yourself, damn, they accepted me? Oh, they must not be doing background checks in this month. You want to find those rooms and do everything you can to get in them and soak up everything. And I recently heard somebody say, to become a good man, you have to have a bee's mentality. And he said, your bees make honey by gathering the best of all the flowers around them, taking it out and letting something better pour from within themselves. And I think it is the best explanation I've ever heard, or the best advice to young folks. Gather all the best around you, take it in, and let your best flow forward. Be a bee. Be a killer bee, but be a bee. So.
Thank you so much for giving your time and talking to me. Thank you. It was very interesting hearing your story, and it was also very inspiring as well. I am also a psychology student right now. And so I'm very appreciative of you coming in and speaking with me.
All right. Have a good one. Y'all take care.
You too.
Have a great day.
You too.